Thank God it's Free Range. You are listening to Free Range Radio Friday with your host, Michael Elves. Pour yourself a beverage and turn up the volume, because here on 101.5 UMFM, the weekend starts now.
UMFM kicking things off for us tonight. That is Dry Heave from Complexion, the new album from Tunic. They are releasing it tonight at the Handsome Daughter alongside Beth and Fox Lake. And they are about to hit the road hard. They're heading over to Europe for several weeks, and then they will be playing South by Southwest as well. Safe travels to those guys, and if you get a chance, head over to the Handsome Daughter and get yourself a copy of the new record. Pretty solid stuff. Speaking of solid stuff, we got a good show for you tonight. We got Ticket Momsters segment, go to the gig recommendations in just a few minutes. Later on, we're going to be talking to psychotherapist and author Janice Berger about her book, Emotional Fitness. And we've got Kirk, lead man of Crowbar, the New Orleans metal act, will be here playing the Park Theater with Corrosion of Conformity. And he gives us the deets on where things are at with that band and with that tour. But first, Partner, who just played the Big Fun Festival back in Winnipeg May 3rd at the Garrick, playing with Winter Sleep. They've just announced a new record called Saturday the 14th coming out in April. And their first single, the video for it is fantastic. I recommend you go check it out. But for now, you can listen to it. This is Longham McQuaid here on 101.5 UMFM.
Ticket Monster. This weather is ridiculous, isn't it? Minus 50. Whew. Well, I've got some show recommendations that should keep the polar vortex at bay as you sit in your toasty warm venue seat. February 3rd and 4th, Neil Young and Crazy Horse visit both Burton Cummings Theater on the Sunday and Centennial Concert Hall on the Monday. As far as I know, there's still tickets left. However, they're going to cost you over $200 each. So, I'm not going. I will, however, be at Justin Timberlake at Bell MTS Place on Monday, February 4th. There are tickets left for that one on Ticketmaster, and they'll run you about $64 for the nosebleed sections. I'm actually going with a few girlfriends, and out of the group, my friend Amber is the super fan. So I was in charge of getting tickets, and I asked Amber where she wanted to sit, and she said, as close as possible, but I want a seat, so the 100 section, or on his lap. I'm pretty sure my credit limit wouldn't allow that, so I got her a seat. in the 100 section. I'm not really a fan of Justin Timberlake. I don't really know any of his songs, but I know he's a fantastic performer, so that's why I'm going. I also know that his new album is called Man of the Woods, and I haven't heard any of it, but I'm expecting dance songs about, you know, like lumberjacks and tree sap and stuff like that. I asked Amber which tune I should play for this segment, and she recommended Breeze Off the Pond, and that sounds woodsy, so yeah, let's play it.
Like breeze off the pond, or trees on the lawn. Wind is always there, they're saying it's just there. Let it blow through you, don't let it move you. Grass is green, it's when you're here with me, okay?
Justin Timberlake with Breeze Off the Pond. He's at Bell MTS Place this Monday, February 4th. Blech, I don't really like the electronic drum stuff. Oh, it makes my skin itchy. But I know he's a great performer, so it should be a good show. So look for my story on Facebook next week. hopefully I won't have scratched off all my skin in the process. I guess we'll see. I've got a couple of local shows to recommend for next week, too. Did you see House Handshake on Facebook last Wednesday? They performed live at the Roslyn, which is a feed on the Village Idiots page. I didn't watch it yet because I'd like to see this band live. If you'd like to see them live too, they're throwing an EP release party at the Pyramid Cabaret next Friday, February 8th. I believe you can get tickets at the door, but check with the Pyramid before you go down there just in case. My last recommendation this week is Jennifer Hansen, Mary Pulver, and Jill Fournier at the Palm Lounge at the Fort Garry Hotel on February 8th and 9th. It's technically, air quotes, free, but of course buy food and drinks when you get there. And honestly, sitting in that beautiful lounge, listening to great musicians, while people bring me food I didn't have to cook myself, sounds lovely right about now. And that's it for this week. I'm going to end this segment with a song you'll hear if you go to House Handshake's EP release at the Pyramid next Friday. This is Ease Me Into It. Have a great week. Bye.
Ease me into it before I get scared and wanna quit. Well, easy come and easy go. Well, we talk so much that we forgot to show. Well, it's easy coming, it's easy go. Well, I've already seen this, already know. So easy coming, it's easy go. Well, I've already seen this, and I already know. So ease me into it, yeah, before I start to. Before I start to, oh, yeah, before I start to give a little bit of work and see how far it'll go. They say it wasn't wrong, but it's just you just might learn something, but and I'm not saying ready, say go. I'm just saying give it some more.
feet into the mist, a stone's throw from the precipice. Pause. Did he jump or did he fall as he gazed into the morn, the morning mist? Did he raise both fists and say to hell with this suggest? Let the rock roll. Let it roll, let it crash down low. There's a house down there, but I lost it long ago. Let it roll, let it crash down low. See my house down there, but I lost it long ago.
Connais la cause, c'est lui pour moi.
We're back here on Thank God It's Free Range, and right before the break, you heard something brand new from Lucy Dacus. That came out yesterday on Matador Records. That is her cover of Edith Piaf's Ma Vie en Rose. Before that, Andrew Bird's latest single from his forthcoming LP, My Finest Work Yet. And yes, that is for tongue firmly in cheek. That was a song called Sisyphus. We are going to be talking to psychotherapist and author Janice Berger in just a moment or two here. But first, Emily Kahn, formerly Emily and Ogden, has a new record coming out. And this here is the first single back here on 101.5 UMFM.
My hands don't work so well no more. My mind ain't so sharp either. My hair in piles on the floor. My appetite now meager. Slowly slipping off the edge of this world. Will you take care of me when I'm dying? Drown in my salt water when I'm crying. I've been trying all night, trying to make it.
Author, psychotherapist, public speaker Janice Berger's conversation about emotional fitness is now available on audible.com. She joins us by phone. Welcome, Janice.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So, Emotional Fitness, the book, you originally published in 2000.
That's right.
And you've gone through several reprints over that time. It's almost 20 years old at this point.
That's right.
What led to the audio version, or rather this conversational version of that book?
Well, I have been asked many times over the years to do an audio version, and this came up and was suggested to me, and it sounded like a good way to kind of revise the original book and add research and other concepts or other information that supports the concepts in the original book. So that's what I've done, and I've done it in the form of a conversation instead of just reading the original manuscript.
What was the impetus for that conversational style versus just kind of a reading of a manuscript?
Well, it was suggested to me, and I had not thought of it before. And upon thinking about it, I realized that there were, you know, I always got a lot of questions, especially from clients who came into therapy because they'd found the original book. And I thought, well, this is an opportunity then to sort of answer some of those questions that I know will pop into people's minds as they're reading. So in this case, as they're listening, so the person on the other end of the conversation was really doing an interview, actually.
So how scripted is that? Because a lot of times, I mean, like, for instance, right now, you and I don't have a script in terms of, like, you don't know what I'm going to ask you. But, you know, for the purpose of an audiobook, there has to be, I would have to imagine, some parameters or specifics, or, like, how do you kind of go about kind of creating the architecture of this thing?
Well, I wrote the script with the experience I had of the kinds of questions that people would ask. So, yes, it has a script.
So the person asking you the questions has essentially been given you've given them the questions to ask you.
Yes, some of them are guidelines, but some of it's quite spontaneous too from him.
So in responding to those kind of spontaneous questions, you know, were there kind of like multiple edits or revisions that you had to do, or are you kind of flying by the seat of your pants in those moments?
Well, sometimes,
yeah.
But yes, it took a few edits to put across. You know, that's what I like about it, though, is that trying to put these concepts across so they're really understandable to anyone.
You mentioned that, you know, you would have patients come in with questions after reading the book. Obviously, I would think over time, specific questions came up again and again. But did you ever have any, like, outliers, like someone who tweaked on something very particular that just had not been addressed prior?
Not really. It was interesting because after the book was published, I really didn't take clients unless they had read the book and understood what they were getting into. So that helped. And I got a lot of, I would say 95% at least of the clients that came then had been in therapy before, but they had felt like there was something missing. And it was the going with the feelings part that was missing. You know, they had, let's say, talk therapy where they talked about their feelings all the time, but they didn't actually go into their feelings and feel them and see where that took them. So there was that. And then also the other interesting thing was that I had a lot of men and did over the years since the book was written come into therapy, because somehow I think it appealed to them, because maybe they felt shut down mostly and they wanted to be able to feel more and express their feelings appropriately in the present more.
The book, like I said, it was about 20 years ago. Your career's over 40 years at this point. So the book almost acts as a midway point in your career. And I'm curious if, you know, looking at, you know, the type of patients you had or the type of experiences you had in your practice prior to the book versus over the past 20 years, like, is there a marked difference in the way that people approach things when they come to you as patients? Or are you still kind of going through the same process with, you know, tapping into emotion?
Well, it is the same process, but people, you know, because of our conditioning to put our feelings away and not deal with them, not feel them completely. It turns people have a completely different worldview, really, after they start doing that, and after they start connecting their current problems to their childhood trauma.
You said, you know, like feeling your feelings. One of the feelings that you discuss at length and really allow people to feel is anger. And this is something that very often people are told to kind of like push it down or resolve it in some way that isn't necessarily actually addressing the anger. I'm wondering if you can kind of talk about, without obviously getting into specifics of patients, but your experiences of coaching people through anger or like allowing them the process of experiencing anger truly.
Well, what happens is that when the anger is put away, as you know, we don't allow children, for example, to express their anger. Somebody else in the household may be okay to expressing their anger, but not the children. And that's put away and can end up, depending on the circumstances of that child's life, can end up as quite a lot of rage. But what happens then as adults, I mean, they may experience road rage or something like that that is fairly common. Like, we know when we meet someone that's actually full of anger. So let's say that person comes into therapy because they're yelling at their kids all the time and that's hurting them. Like, they really don't want to be that kind of parent, but they keep doing it. So then we always start with the trigger. So we would start with that person just, first of all, telling me about his or her feelings, and then speaking out loud to that child, going with the trigger, trying to get right into that feeling. And one of the very common ones that would happen would be, the parent being triggered by the child not listening. He never listens to me. So the client would start off trying to speak to that child with as much force as they were feeling about not being listened to. And often in that particular case, it was really interesting to see that it often went very, very quickly to the client not yelling at the child, but yelling at their own mom or dad, "You never listen to me." So that's sort of a good example of how you start with the current trigger, mm-hmm. and it takes you right back to the early trauma.
Yeah, it's interesting. There seems to be kind of like a weird parallel between like the escalation of a feeling and sort of the regression of a feeling as well. That like very often the amplification in the moment is also seeing sort of psychologically the person kind of going backwards to those childhood issues.
If it's been an overreaction that has happened because of the trigger, and that's actually usually a lot easier than if it's an underreaction. But an underreaction, it covers the same kind of early pain, and it's harder to get at because that underreactors, they tolerate things that aren't good for them. And they have learned to be victims, really. And then it might not be quite so loud when they're triggered. They may be quite quietly feeling back to some early issues. And also, I mean, these clients would do some things to take themselves back to their past too. Like, they do a timeline, for instance, and they try to remember just cognitively some of the things that happened to them in their childhood. But they were not just then bringing them to the session as something to talk about. They were trying to get back into that scene. Like, when they were humiliated, for example, by some adult in their life, or they were put down all the time, or all that sort of verbal and emotional abuse that was suffered. And so as they do that and get back into that earlier scene, they really begin to have some empathy for themselves as a child.
And then I would have to imagine then, particularly because a lot of this deals with, you know, issues as parents, that then dealing with the empathy for themselves as the child then triggers empathy for the children that they are parenting at that point.
Yes, absolutely. That's exactly right. And you know what? If we can realize that if our children are allowed to express their full range of their feelings, then they don't have to develop a whole range of unacceptable behaviors in order to try to be heard. So if kids are acting out or acting on their feelings all over the place, it's because they need to be heard. And, you know, what we've done in our culture is we've labeled kids' misbehavior or you know, their behavior as misbehavior because it doesn't suit us. But there, no child misbehaves that isn't trying to be heard, that doesn't want a need met that isn't being met. So once we change that and we feel what it was like for ourselves to not be heard and not have choices and have rigid rules in the family, and we see how that has affected us, yes, we're able to be much more empathetic with our child and listen better.
One of the things you talk about listening to is crying, like letting crying be part of the process and not something to be kind of like tamped down.
Well, crying in our culture also has been seen as such a weakness, and it's such a good example of how our natural healing, emotional healing power has been subverted, because when we cry, we've known for over 30 years that with emotional tears, we're getting rid of stress hormones. And so it's a necessary part of our emotional system working, is to be able to rid our bodies of these defunct chemicals that we really don't need. You know, because we used to believe that stress was, the response was fight or flee, and we know now that the more common one is freeze. In other words, kids can't fight or flee often, and even adults can't in many, many modern situations. So our body prepares us for fight or flight, and all we can do is freeze, so we're sitting there with all these hormones being pumped into our body to prepare us for something we can't do. So to know that if we cry, we get rid of a lot of those, it's like a biological necessity, crying.
Right, like this is like the physics notions of energy, that it has to go somewhere.
Yes. And most people who were not allowed to cry as kids, or were not held so they could let their tears flow, they grow up to not be able to cry, not to be able to grieve enough to free themselves of the heaviness. And, you know, those kinds of things turn into depression.
The book is called Emotional Fitness, and obviously the fitness aspect, you do talk about the mind-body relationship, and, you know, that's what fitness kind of seems to always make me think of, is the body particularly. When did you kind of first come across the mind-body relationship? I mean, in your years of practice, what led you to that discovery?
Oh, well, that's a long time ago, Michael.
Yeah.
And I went into therapy myself with a psychiatrist back in the late 60s, early 70s, when this was first being recognized. But because of my own therapy and what happened to me there, I became very convinced of, you know, that this was a natural process that we all possess.
So then in going through it yourself Are you drawing on the, sort of that when you are in treatment with patients? Like, are you thinking about your own processes, or do you have to kind of approach a patient with sort of, I don't want to say a blank slate, but just kind of like a completely open approach, or do you?
No, I'm not thinking about myself at all when I'm with clients. I am a facilitator. I'm not interpreting their experience for them. I'm not telling them what it means to them. I'm helping them go through the feelings to the point that they have those insights for themselves. And that was what happened for me. And what I had done university courses and other training to be a psychotherapist, but this process and understanding our own natural healing power that's how I understood it, by being involved myself.
Okay.
That's what made me passionate about it. Let's put it that way.
Sure. Yeah. I guess I wasn't necessarily inferring that you approach specifically like each patient with like your own rubric, but just that like you had gone through that experience. So that's how you kind of broach things with them, but maybe sounds like we're...
Well, it's the same as if a parent gets connected to what it was really like for them as a child. And, you know, what happens is one of the biggest defenses that a child has is to feel that what's going on is their fault.
Mm.
So you'll have people say, you know, even if they were beaten or something, they'll say, well, I deserved it, looking back. But that defense of thing is because if you think something's your fault, it gives you a tiny little bit of control that you don't have if it's somebody else's fault altogether. And besides which, little children can't afford to see that the truth of the parent who is uncaring and hurtful and telling them basically over and over that they're pretty worthless. I don't know if I'm answering.
Yeah, no,
question.
No. I think you are. I mean, there's so many questions that swirl around this.
I guess what I lost my train of thought a little bit there, because what I wanted to say was like that. So that parent, when they turn the corner in their own exploring or their own therapy, to be able to have more empathy for them, their own self as a child, then they gain empathy for their child, as we spoke about.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the same as, you know, me having my own therapy and clearing out my own pain to the extent that I could. Then I could have empathy easily for anyone. Mm-hmm. Even anyone who came in with, you know, let's say very, very different values than me, or sometimes people come in yelling and screaming about politicians or things like that. But I can have empathy because I have empathy for myself.
Right. You mentioned people coming in and screaming about politicians. I'm curious about kind of, you know, changes in society, because it does seem that there is a rise in sort of public displays of anger over the last, you know, half decade or so, that, or like, it seems to have been normalized in some way on social media. And I'm curious, as, you know, a practitioner, whether you see that as the case, or is this kind of what you've seen in private with patients, just kind of writ large?
Well, I guess, you know, one of the reasons that I have wanted to write and that I wanted to do this audiobook is because I believe that, the fact that we repress and suppress feelings and in children means that we send people out into the world who may act out those repressed feelings in a very detrimental way. And that's exactly what happens. We see people acting out their anger. We see them acting out their need for power and control. And we're seeing more and more of that, and more of people not being able to empathize with other people who are different from them.
Empathy obviously like a key sort of emotional fitness tool that like ultimately in order, especially as a parent, to parent effectively, you do have to practice empathy with the child and with yourself as a parent.
Yes, but it's not a, like what I'm trying to say is it's not something, it's not a practice. It simply is there. It's there once you really have gained empathy for the child that you were. It just exists. I remember the Nuremberg trials. One of the judges said that evil is the absence of empathy. And I mean, I think we see that all over, everywhere we look today, not having empathy for people who are in pretty dire straits. You can't teach, I don't think you can teach somebody empathy. Maybe you can, to some extent. Like, you can change people's perceptions often, and that can help a little bit. But what really helps is that connection to old, unfinished business in your own life.
Mm-hmm. Conversation about emotional fitness is available on audible.com. Is the emotional fitness the book still currently in print? Like, what's the latest edition?
It's also on Amazon. It's been selling for 19 years now.
Perfect. Janice, thank you very much for taking some time to have this conversation, and I encourage people to listen to the much larger conversation on the Audible version.
Well, thank you, Michael. It was my pleasure.
All right. Well, touring with Corrosion of Conformity and landing at the Park Theater on February 7th, Crowbar coming to town. Kirk Weinstein from the group joins me by phone. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good. Right, heading to San Francisco, and the tour's gone great.
You're what, about a week and a half in to the tour so far?
Yeah, about a week and a half. First show was on a Saturday in San Antonio, so we made our way, you know, we made our way out west and we're heading north.
Sure enough. Brace yourself, just a FYI. It's a little colder up here than it is in San Fran. So I wanted to ask how you guys landed on the bill with Corrosion of Conformity, because you're doing the entire tour with them, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, correct. I mean, just, you know, I've been friends with Pepper since we're, you know, teenagers, basically, and played down with him for 22 years. So, you know, we keep in touch, and, you know, we've talked about this for a while, you know, doing Corrosion and Crowbar. We did it back in 2005, and it worked out great. So, you know, it was kind of a no-brainer, and it's really a great package. So it's working out killer.
So 14 years ago was the last time you guys shared the...
Yep. Early. I guess like about May of 2005 or something, was May or June was the tour last time.
Vibe-wise on this tour, so, you mean, like I said, we're only about a week and a half into it. Just like kind of riding a bike, you guys gotten kind of back into the groove of being on tour with each other, or is there any changes?
Yeah, it's awesome. You know, because we did a lot of touring together, obviously, when we went down, you know, together. So It's great being back on tour with you know, with the COC guys and Weed Eater. We've known those guys forever too, and they were actually on the 2005 tour with us as well. And then Mothership is, you know, it's new to me, but they're an awesome band and great guys, you know. So the package is really, really strong.
Right. Now, with Mothership, like, do you take time out to kind of watch their sets and see what they're about, considering they're new to you?
Yeah, usually I'm able to watch Mothership set, and I kind of get ready, you know, during Weed Eater. But I mean, I've seen Weed Eater, you know, a great band, but I've seen them so many times. But yeah, Mothership, I pretty much check out their set, you know, every night. Great, you know, just classic rock and roll type,
right?
Stuff, you know, great melodies, great guitar play, and you know, just great all around band. So it's a lot of fun,
right? Now, like you said, you're getting ready for your set when Weed Eater on the stage. Playing support, is it a freeing thing not to have like your band's name at the top of the poster? Like, does that kind of take some of the pressure off you?
I guess to a degree it does. I mean, you know, we've in the United States, we've been doing direct support to the headliner, and it's actually a better spot, you know, especially during the week. I mean, people, you know, even if people just can't stay that late, you know, when they have work early in the morning and whatnot. So a lot of times, you know, when you're a headliner, you know, by the end of your set, it, you know, people start to leave just because they got to get home and get to sleep, you know. So it's
right.
Kinda, on the weekends, it's great, but you know, it's kind of less pressure not headlining. And it's great. I mean, for us, you know, we really have a prime spot. We're normally on about, you know, between 9 and 9:30, and you know, play about 45 minutes. So that's perfect for us.
And you're still getting kind of the audience has the energy, and they're not looking for the exits.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm not saying that you know, it's just the nature of being a headliner. You know, it doesn't matter who you are. You know, it's just when you're playing clubs, you know, it's like these venues want the people in there, you know, as long as possible, and you know, to buy drinks and whatnot. And it's, you know, a lot of times they you know, there's nothing worse than having to go on late, you know, on a Sunday night or a Monday, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, where they put you on stage at 11:30 or something. It's like, you know, I mean, many, many times I've had people buy a ticket, come in, buy merchandise from Crowbar, take some pictures, and say, man, sorry, you know, I got to get up at 4:30 in the morning. Just wanted to support you, you know. I'm not going to be able to stay for the show. And that's happened many, many times, you know. So it's a lot better going on earlier.
I have to admit, I've gone to a gig just to buy a record and say hey and jet it.
Yeah, man. I mean, it happens, you know. It's like, I mean, you know, it's just life goes on. You know, life has to happen. And it's like, you know, a lot of people A lot of people are able to take off work the next day or what, you know, whatnot, but a lot of them can't. And,
no.
You know, when you've got to get up super early, you know, you can't really, you know, it sucks, you know, when we're headlining and I realize, you know, that we have, you know, five local bands and here we are going scheduled for 11:30 at night. And it's like, you know, I mean, it's just, I'd much rather be a direct support.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned you guys are going to do about 45 minutes. Building a set at this point with like the just giant discography, how do you go about kind of like figuring out what goes on a 45 minute set like that? Like, are you?
It's pretty difficult, but I mean, it's kind of like, you know, we try to play. I mean, we have 11 records and we're only able to do 9 songs. So
yeah.
But you know, there's certain songs we feel we have to play. And you know, we kind of just try to, you know, I mean, we kind of just play what we consider to be the crowd favorites and, you know, the most of the ones that have been videos or whatnot, you know? So, I mean, you know, like off of Crowbar, I think the self-titled, we open up the set with All I Had I Gave, which is, you know, our first video. And you know, we do a couple of things off Odd Fellows Rest. I think we actually do like 3 off of Odd Fellows. We just celebrated the 20th anniversary of that record. That's one of our favorites. But you know, we do Walk with Knowledge Wisely off of Symmetry in Black. We do the Cemetery Angels off of Some of the Wicked Hand. You know, Planets Collide. We close with like Broken Glass, which is a great closing song. So it's kind of just, you know, like a little quick greatest hit, so to speak. You know, what we got, just to give you an idea of, you know, it's some fast stuff, some slow doomy stuff. You know, it's a good mixture of old and new. And that's you know, you do what you can do in a lot of 45 minutes.
You mentioned that Oddfellows Rest celebrated its 20th anniversary last year. What was the experience like, you know, kind of celebrating or marking something like 2 decades on? And like, did you kind of like go back and listen to the masters and sort of like reconsider the record and where you were at when you first recorded it? Like, what was that experience like?
Well, I mean, a lot of work went into the Oddfellows stuff last year, because we actually played the record in its entirety at Roadburn Festival in the Netherlands, and then we did it at a hometown show as well.
Right.
So we had to go relearn, which was a lot of work. Go relearn something that was written 20 years ago. You know, most of it was forgotten. But it was a lot of fun, and I learned a lot relearning it, you know, just to kind of see where my mind was at back then writing the stuff, you know. So it was a lot of work, but it was definitely worth it.
You said, you know, kind of thinking about where your mind was at, like, it kind of, did it take you back? Like, were you thinking about kind of like creatively where you were at and sort of the process and how things might have changed and, you know, how you write now and what kind of
Yeah, I mean, it kind of opened my mind to, you know, to writing. Even when we did kind of celebrated the 20th anniversary of the Broken Glass record as well. We didn't do the whole record, but we did a lot of stuff off of it, so we had to go relearn. It was the same thing with Oddfellows. It kind of opens your mind and gives you, you know, perspective of it just kind of makes you think differently. It's like, wow, I was really thinking different 20 years ago, you know. But it's a good thing, you know. I'm excited to write the next, you know, the next stuff after relearning a lot of the old material, and kind of gives you a different perspective on everything.
I read on Ghost Cult Mag that you are working on a record for this year. It's been 4 years, I guess, since the last, or three and a half, something like that, since the last.
The last record came out around beginning of November 2016.
16, so okay. Like
two and a half years.
Curious if you can tell us a little bit about what this new record is going to be like, or where the process is at right now.
Actually, right now I'm doing a solo thing, which is, I call it, it's basically mellow Crowbar.
Mellow
Crowbar. Not an acoustic record. In fact, there's zero acoustic guitar on it. There's a lot of clean guitar. But it's just something, you know, I've wanted to do for a long, long time. So that's almost done. I need to do a lot of the lyrics and vocals, but musically it's almost complete. So I'll finish that when I get home, and then we'll start writing the new Crowbar. So, you know, we're kind of still in, we've been in tour mode. Jesus, we haven't stopped, you know, for 2.5 years, really.
Right.
So, you know, in between touring and what, you know, and stuff, I've been trying to work a little bit on this solo thing, but I'm, you know, anxious to get that complete, get it out, because it's something that there'll be no touring or anything for. It's just something I want to do, you know, that I've always wanted to do. So hopefully the fans dig it, but if not, I'm enjoying it again, you know.
Sure.
So it's a lot of fun.
You said it's something you've always wanted to do. Why now then? Like what made this the time to do this record, this solo thing?
I don't know. I was, you know, speaking a little bit to the our record label about doing it. They thought it was a great idea, and you know, it's something that, you know, I mean, I listen to all styles of music. You know, believe me. I mean, Crowbar's live, especially, is a very sonically heavy band.
Mm-hmm.
But I really don't listen to that much heavy music. I listen to a lot more, you know, 70s and 80s stuff, and you know, a lot of pop stuff and whatever. But it's just something. Something I've always wanted to do, you know, with Crowbar, you know, certain, some of these majority songs just would not fit, you know, the stuff that I have for the solo record. So it's just something to kind of get off my chest, really.
Will it come out under your own name, or do you have like a project name for it? Or
yeah, it'll just be me, Kirk Winson, you know, whatever. It's not a band, you know, it's just me. So, and like I said, it's nothing I intend on really, you know, doing live or anything. I mean, mm-hmm. maybe one show or something here or there, but that's totally it. I mean, everything's all the focus is on Crowbar, of course.
Right. Now, the process of writing these songs, has that, like, opened your eyes in terms of writing for Crowbar at all? Like, is there something that you've done or experienced writing this solo stuff that has made you reconsider what you do as a writer for Crowbar?
I mean, to a degree it has. I think really going back and learning the older material from the, you know, from Odd Fellows and stuff like that's actually given me more of a spark than what I'm doing with the solo thing.
Right.
Because it's actual, you know, it's actually Crowbar stuff, you know, where this, like I said, it's more of a mellow version of Crowbar, but it's just something I want to do.
Right.
But you know, it's definitely, you know, I'm glad I'm doing it. But you know, I am eager to also to finish it up and you know, just see what the reaction is. Like I said, if it doesn't, you know, people don't care for it, that's fine. I don't, you know, but I personally think that they will. It's something I need to do. But you know, my main focus, of course, is Crowbar. So.
For sure. Kirk, before I let you go, I want to get you to pick a track that we can play for listeners. And I guess maybe something that wouldn't be on the Crowbar set during this support, like maybe something that you wouldn't necessarily get to because you've only got like 9 songs. What would you pick and maybe a reason why you're picking that?
As a track to play?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. That's a tough one. You know, like because of this. Like I'll say this, when we do our headlining sets, you know, some of the other songs, it's kind of like, for instance, right now we're kind of flip-flopping each night from The Lasting Dose and To Build a Mountain, which are both off of Sonic Excess in its purest form, because I love both songs, and they're usually both are always included in our headlining set. So one of those tunes, we've kind of been leaning a little more toward To Build a Mountain for the live set. It's more of a little more uppity, you know, so maybe choose A Lasting Dose off of Sonic Excess.
All right, well, we'll go with that one. Kirk, safe travels in the interim, and looking forward to seeing you here at the Park Theater on February 7th with Corrosion and Conformity.
Awesome. Thanks so much, man. Looking forward to it.
Take care.